Mark 6, 14 through 29. Please stand or take whatever posture works best for you for the reading of God's word. King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some were saying, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and for this reason, these powers are at work in him. But others said, it is Elijah. And others said, it is a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. For Herod himself had sent the men who arrested John, bound him, and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because Herod had married her. For John had been telling Herod, it is not lawful for you to marry your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to kill him. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he protected him. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he liked to listen to him. But an opportunity came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his courtiers and officers and for the leaders of Galilee. When the daughter of Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it. And he solemnly swore to her, whatever you ask me, I will give you, even half of my kingdom. She went out and said to her mother, what should I ask for? She replied, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately she rushed back to the king and requested, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. The king was deeply grieved, yet out of regard for his oaths and for the guests, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately the king sent a soldier of the guard with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl. Then the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard about it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. The word of the Lord.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. If you are between, what is it, three and third grade-ish, if you're a child and you would like to go down to a junior worship, we have activities planned downstairs, and you're welcome to head out there now if you'd like. We'll have some adults there with you, and then we'll bring you back up after a little bit. Boy, as we were reading all those scriptures about dancing and David dancing and singing all those songs and the worship team leading us, I was sort of looking around and I was realizing, I don't know if we're quite back in our sort of groove dance-wise here at the church yet. I mean, I'm certainly not, but that's to be expected. But we're sort of getting back into it. Boone mentioned he's still getting a feel for his singing voice back in the worship area after being off for a couple weeks. I think our dance moves. So maybe, in between now and next Sunday, you could go home in the mirror and do a little sidestep and a clap every once in a while, throw a shoulder in there and, a head bob or something like that. What we need is a few of the people who do dance well. Every time Emily Williams is here, I feel inspired, right? I want to be sitting right behind her because she's so great about it. I need to get a few of them sitting up front. So Lewis, you're up front. I mean, Alpha, you were doing great, so thank you. Okay, well, a story for you this morning. Once upon a time, there was a man named Aristobulus. Now, Aristobulus is not central to our story, but he is at the beginning of it. You see, Aristobulus had a father, a ruthless and terrible man, who was named for all of the wrong reasons, Herod the Great. And Aristobulus had a brother who was also named Herod, Herod Antipas. And Aristobulus had another brother who was also named Herod, Herod Philip. It's sort of like the New Heart show here. You remember that? Hi, I'm Larry. It's my brother Daryl and my other brother Daryl. This is what it was like in this family. And so when Aristobulus had a child, a daughter, as it turns out, in an effort to carry forward the family name, he called her, can you guess it? Herodias. Now, Aristobulus died in 7 BC, and his fearsome father died a few years later. Again, neither of them are the main characters in today's story. But the brothers Herod and the niece Herodias most certainly are. Indeed, this terrible triad of Herods, whom we find at the heart of our tragic tale this morning, have everything to do with Mark's main point for us. You see, when Daddy Herod died, Herod the Great, that is, the Romans stepped in. And they split his kingdom up into four territories. Did you know this? And they gave it to each of his four children. Now, this wasn't the four Metcalf children, or even the four Reed children. These kids were Herod's. And Herod's took after their father. These children were unscrupulous and untethered to any sort of conventional sense of morality or kindness or fair play. As such, the children, these four children for whom the kingdom was divided, were insanely jealous of one another. They were rivals of one another. They were eager to steal what the other person had, brother or not. And so they plotted against one another. Ultimately, it was power and wealth and control of the land that they lusted for and longed for more than anything else, these children of Herod. Which is why when Aristobulus died, his brother, Herod Philip, swooped in to claim his riches. And he did so by marrying Aristobulus' daughter, Herodias, his niece. Now, marrying one's niece wasn't uncommon, but it wasn't all that common either. And yet, in any case, for them, it seemed to have worked. Herod Philip consolidated power, and he and Herodias, his niece, had a child, a daughter whose name Josephus, a first century historian, tells us, a daughter whose name was Salome. Meanwhile, Aristobulus's other brother Herod, are you keeping all these straight now? It doesn't matter. Herod Antipas, the one Jesus would later call, and not in any sort of complimentary way, that fox. Herod Antipas married the daughter of the king of Nabatea. This was a kingdom that bordered Galilee on the east. It was a marriage between rulers to secure peace between their two territories. And frankly, it made a lot of sense. But sensibility is not something any of the Herods were particularly well suited for, unfortunately, as Herod Antipas would demonstrate in short order. So to recap, we've got Herod the Great, who has four children. The kingdoms are divided among them. Two of those children are Herod Philip and my other brother, Herod Antipas. Herod Philip marries Herodias, his niece. Herod Antipas marries someone who borders his kingdom to seek peace between them. That's where we are until Herod Antipas messes it all up by setting his sights on none other than Aristobulus' daughter, Herodias, the same niece his brother Herod Philip had already married. We don't know for sure historically whether it was just a play for power. Perhaps it was a way simply to spite one or more of his brothers. Perhaps it was simply a matter of lust. Who knows for sure? But what we do know is this. Herod Antipas promptly divorces his Nabataean princess and lures his brother's wife, Herodias, away from Herod Philip, which was stupid on a number of levels. On the one hand, it broke ties with the bordering neighbors who promptly declared war against Galilee. On the other hand, it created an incestuous tangle of Herodian drama, uncommon even in the first century and certainly in any other. You see, Herod Philip refused to grant a divorce to his wife slash niece. And since she was not allowed to divorce her husband slash uncle, when Herod Antipas eventually married her, she became the first woman in history married not to one, but two of her uncles simultaneously. In one fell swoop, if you can keep this in mind, she became the wife, the niece, and the sister-in-law of two Herods at the very same time. So, Herodias moves in with Herod Antipas, and she brings her daughter Salome with her. Which means that with this move and this marriage, Salome, again, there's the last confusing thing I'll ask you to get your mind around. Salome, with this marriage and this move, becomes all at once Herod Antipas's niece, since she was the brother of Philip's daughter, his grandniece, since she was his brother Aristobulus's granddaughter, and his stepdaughter by marriage to his other niece slash wife. To make it even more complex, Salome was already both the daughter and grandniece of her own father, as well as the daughter and grandniece of her own mother. Do you get all that? It doesn't matter. We may gossip about scandal in high places today, but there has never been as rich material as we find here with the Herod family. And so, it is into this convoluted context that John the Baptist enters the scene today, and precisely where his tragic demise begins. You see, John the Baptist is a prophet, which means John is a truth teller. His one task on earth is to speak truth into the world wherever he goes, and so he does. Regardless of whether he's talking to a commoner or a king or anyone in between. Which means when the religious leaders from Jerusalem come to him, he says, "You brood of vipers." And when the soldiers come to him, he says, "Stop extorting people. Stop accusing people falsely, and just for kicks, stop complaining about your pay." And it also means that when the Tetrarch of Galilee, Herod Antipas, is within earshot of the prophet John, John refuses to hold back and reminds him of his adultery and the havoc he has wreaked on his incestuous family. Now, we don't know exactly how the soldiers responded to John. Apparently, they went seeking advice. We don't know for certain how the religious leaders responded to John, other than they feared him. We do, however, know precisely what Herod Antipas thought of John when John spoke the truth to him. You heard Jen read it just a few moments ago, as Mark puts it. Herod Antipas feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and a holy man, and Herod protected him. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, Mark tells us, and yet he liked to listen to the prophet, the truth teller, to John, which oddly is why he threw him in jail, strangely. In his own distorted way, Herod Antipas was trying to placate his wife Herodias, who cared a lot less for the truth that John preached, while simultaneously protecting him from his wife's murderous plots, and he thought jail would be the place to do that. And so, we have Herod Antipas living with his niece, Herodias, and his daughter, niece, grandniece, multiple other things, Salome. He has John in the dungeons below him, and he has a murderous wife who wants to get rid of John, whatever it takes. By the way, before we judge Herodias too harshly for all of this, chances are she didn't have a lot of say in any of what was going on here. And the fact is, if Herod decided to listen to his conscience and listen to John and divorce his niece slash wife, well, Herod, as the ruler of Galilee, he would be just fine. He's got all the power in the world. But Herodias, well, the same cannot be said for her. If her uncle slash husband were to divorce her, what was she supposed to do? She couldn't go back to Herod Philip, of course. In fact, she would have nowhere to go. And so, she fears John. She hates John for his truth-telling, and she's frightened that he has her husband's ear. And so Mark tells us Herodias wants to kill John, which, as we learn, is precisely what she does. at hubby Herod's, uncle Antipas's, birthday banquet, Salome, the daughter-in-law, slash niece, slash grandniece, comes in to dance for Herod and his guests. It is a troubling scene on a number of levels, not least of which is this. It was hard for it to come across in the English translation, but when Mark describes Salome, he doesn't use any of the titles I've just used to describe her. Rather, he simply calls her this, Chorasion in Greek. It's the same word he used just a chapter ago to describe Jairus' 12-year-old child. It means little girl. When the young girl comes in to dance for the powerful men, she dances so well and pleases her stepfather slash uncle slash great uncle Herod and his guests so greatly that the tetrarch, presumably drunk at this point, offers this child a rather rash gift. Anything she wants, up to half his kingdom. And the sickening scene, the perverse scene, only gets worse with what comes next. Herodias, seizing her chance, instructs the girl to ask for the head of John the Baptist. And then notice this. It's actually the Chorasion herself, the child, who adds the gruesome detail that this grisly gift should be delivered up on a platter. Unsurprisingly, this whole scene sobers Herod just a bit. The request for John the Baptist's head. He knows, of course, it's wrong to behead the Baptist, and Mark tells us he does not want to do it. But with the usual vanity of kings, this man lives in fear. Fear of losing face, fear of embarrassment, fear of seeming sympathetic to a lowly rabble-rouser stuck in his dungeon. And so Herod, who is in fact the most powerful man in the room, comes across as the absolute weakest and assents to the beheading of the prophet. And John the Baptist is executed. The righteous man dies for a dance. And so our story ends. As John's disciples take his lifeless, headless body and lay it in a tomb. Mark 6, 14 through 29. So, why has Mark shared this story with us, and why have we rehearsed it again this morning? Curiously, Mark doesn't say. He narrates the story and leaves it there. So what are we to take from it? What is the lesson from our gospel this morning? You know, according to Matthew's gospel, when he records this story, he says that when Jesus hears of John's death, Jesus is shaken, deeply shaken. And he departs in a boat to a lonely place where he might grieve by himself. And I'd like to invite you to sit with that description for just a moment. When Jesus hears the story I've just shared with you, the one that Mark shares with us this morning, the news of his cousin and his colleague's dreadful demise, the one thing Jesus doesn't do is preach. He doesn't turn the horror story into some sort of morality tale. He doesn't attempt to minimize the misery or lessen the loss with any sort of pie in the sky by and by. Rather, he withdraws into silence. He mourns. He lingers over the pain and creates space for it to spend itself. Which suggests to me that perhaps the point of this story The point of Mark sharing it without commentary and the point of Jesus' silence in response to it is that sometimes it's actually best if we don't slap meaning and purpose on every tragic human experience. For some, human hurts can't be salvaged with a tidy point or a trim parable. And perhaps the best thing we can do in these moments, hearing stories like this, when a righteous man suffers for nothing, perhaps the best we can do is what Mark does and simply tell the story, acknowledge the tragedy, remember, honor those who have suffered, and like Jesus, mourn. Period. And although I can't tell you exactly why, I somehow find that incredibly healing. But note this as well. After Jesus has sought out his solitude, lived with the pain, grieved the loss, the very next thing he does in both Matthew's gospel and Mark's is he turns around and feeds people. Which tells me something further, that while it is our task to honor the silence, to create space for grief, to mourn freely, when we're ready, we are also tasked with turning back to our neighbors in whatever capacity we have left and provide for one another, trusting that somehow it will be enough. Even if we can't explain how or why. To be honest, I found it strange to hear this passage this morning and declare, thanks be to God. I wonder if you felt the same way. But honestly, I'm glad I did. Because it was my reminder that God doesn't ask me to pretend that tragedy and evil don't exist in this world. Instead, God invites me to acknowledge them, as Mark did, as Jesus did, to mourn them, and then when I am able, to return to my neighbor and offer what I can despite the tragedy and evil. When I think of it that way, I say to myself, the word of the Lord indeed. Thanks be to God. Amen.